you have questions about particular aspects, I'm going to be
You want to show that you got the weight of the law on your side?
That was my intent, Your Honor. And certainly the weight of, actually, I was leaning more to the weight of the facts. But,
all right, there you go.
A little of both. I will be doing the direct argument on behalf of L&F Holmes and Larry Matrenga. My co-counsel, George W. Healy, will be handling the rebuttal. Am I attached to the microphone all right?
You are attached.
All right. Well, I have a very complicated case to explain in 15 minutes. So like most lawyers in that situation, I've reduced it to 5 bullet points. But there may be a particular aspect of the case that the court wishes me to begin by addressing.
Go ahead.
Let's hear with the bullet points.
What your organization is.
All right. Well, bullet point number one comes in the form of a question. And the question is, what is the name? What is the name of the person who made the decision to deny water service to Roundhill? Mr. Healy asked that question at the city's 30B6 deposition. The city's 30B6 representative answered, I do not know. So we went on a paper chase and tried to find out from different witnesses what they knew. We were never able to identify the name of the person who made the decision. Nobody came forward in a deposition and said, I'm the decider. Nobody came forward in an affidavit and said,
George H.W. Bush.
Right. Well, he was not involved in this case. Right. What difference it makes is we have no direct evidence as to the process by which the decision was made, and we have no direct evidence as to the factors that were considered. For example, did the person who made the decision consider that Ordinance 2501 applies outside city limits? Did they look at the evidence that Roundhill was grandfathered? Did they think there was a fire flow problem? We can't ask them because we don't know who they are. So both sides are in here with circumstantial evidence asking this court to infer that this must be what the person looked at. Now, when you have a process like that, what you're looking at is, was this decision made according to law? Were the rules followed? Were the factors that were considered the permissible factors? Was discretion exercised? If so, was it discretion exercised in a manner consistent with the Constitution? If you don't know who made the decision or what process they followed, it is very difficult to determine.
Ms. Larry, listen. This is a great argument to a district judge that a summary judgment should not go forward because discovery has not been completed or has not been given in good faith. But there is a summary judgment here, and the questions are, did you even make a prima facie case to go forward in this case? Now, there's you know, you have the 1982, we have the FHA, we have the substantive due process, procedural due process claims before us. And it seems to me who the person is, we need to get to the, you know, to the bottom whether or not the court was correct in granting summary judgment. And if it wasn't, you need to tell us why it wasn't.
Because there's evidence that the city acted in bad faith. Because, let's start with the question I just raised. Does anybody here really believe that the city's 30B6 witness did not know the name of the person who made the decision? Obviously they knew. And in case they didn't, we filed a motion to compel them to provide us with an answer. The court granted the motion, ordered the city's witness to appear for a supplementary 30B6 deposition. We asked them again, and they denied again. They again failed to provide the information. I didn't put that cite in the brief, but that is page number 7282 in this court's record. Now, if this court believes that the people at the city do not know the name of the person who made the decision, I have a bridge and it's for sale and I hope to meet with you after argument. Obviously, they are not being
okay,
candid.
But if they're lying about who made the decision, then again, why isn't that a matter of sanctions and so on as part of the discovery fight in the district court? And then you come to us and say, we didn't have, you know, a 56F sort of argument. We didn't have sufficient discovery and so on and so forth. I don't know. It was, I will say this. This was cumbersome to make our way through three, 60, 70-page briefs. I did it, and I could have missed it, but I didn't see the 56F argument. In other words, I didn't see an argument that you're saying we didn't get adequate discovery and therefore we shouldn't have had to respond to a summary judgment.
We got adequate discovery. We were allowed to depose everybody we wanted to depose.
Let's get to the point here of, I guess, bottom line, what evidence do you have besides the city, in your view, lying about who made the decision, that the decision violates the United States Constitution, the Fair Housing Act, or anything else that we might, as a federal court, care about?
Well, we start with the fact that we have a property right, okay? The U.S. Supreme Court has held that interference with use of real property is at least potentially.
Do you have a property right to water, or do you just have a property right not to be deprived of water once given?
Well, we have more than one right. For a start, remember, we already had water. They approved the installation of a water meter in 2007. They approved connection to the city water system in 2007. Their witness testified.
That's sort of mired in, I have to say, that was mired in confusion as to what exactly those agreements meant. The wastewater agreement and then the other thing that they gave. To me, I didn't see that you showed that that was tantamount to, you now have, like, I'm sitting in my house with water and then all of a sudden the city stops giving me water even though I paid my bill. I didn't see it as being the equivalent of that.
Okay, well, what I was actually talking about at that point was service verification request 70083. We applied for water service. They approved the water application. They ordered installation of a city water meter. But let's go back to the wastewater service agreement and the will serve letter. If you read the will serve,
that's what I was looking for.
Right. If you read the will serve letter, you'll see what it says is that we have water available. And if you follow these steps, if you do these things we ask you to do, then we will permit you to connect. The final sentence is, and if you complete all these steps, the city shall approve. The city engineer's office shall examine and approve.
I don't remember the exact language. It's not some subject to city council, subject to something else?
Absolutely. And it's subject to, for the purposes of express contract, that falls under the spread on the minutes rule. Now, you don't have an express contract with the city unless it's spread on the city minutes. And this was because they gave us the to-do list and the will serve letter. We checked off all the blanks. We got to the end of the to-do list, the final step, sign the wastewater service agreement and apply for connection with the county. When we got to the final step, we went to the city council. The city council approved the signing of the wastewater service agreement. The city council ordered that the wastewater service agreement and its attachments be spread on the minutes, city minutes. And at this point, they put the wastewater service agreement and the will serve letter together in the city minutes, indicating that the will serve letter had become an attachment to the wastewater service agreement. The will serve letter had become part of a contract with the city. Now,
I understand that part, but as I understand the argument, somewhere around 2009, there's an enactment of a new ordinance that increases the amount of water flow for fire protection, and then they indicate that that's insufficient to grant you this permit. What do you say about that scenario that's before us?
Well, if you read the ordinance, you'll find that it applies within city limits, and for good reason. The city doesn't have authority to enact extraterritorial ordinances.
Doesn't that end up being sort of a cloudy legal question? Am I looking at the intentionality of the conduct of the city? I mean, isn't that the way the judge handled that particular argument, and isn't that justified? That it's not clear, or would not have been clear to the decision makers whether the ordinance applied or not outside the city limits?
No, I don't think the trial judge ever picked up on that point. I don't think he addressed it at all. The other thing the ordinance says is that any development that reaches a certain point is grandfathered. And Chris Reedman testified at the 781 Group preliminary injunction hearing that Round Hill was already connected. He didn't use the word grandfathered, but he implied in that testimony. His testimony, he was responding to questions about why Round Hill was being treated differently from the 781 group. So even if the ordinance applies outside city limits, the city's own witnesses have testified that Round Hill was grandfathered.
What is the current status of this project?
The current status is that my client has been forced to take bankruptcy due to cash flow problems. He's doing a debtor-in-possession bankruptcy, so we're able to proceed in the court.
But so I thought at some point they did give him the water. After all this thing about the flow line, and they found out that there was that thing that was turned off that should have been turned on or whatever, and so no, they never did grant the water rights?
Well, you've got the sequence of events wrong. The 781 group lost funding in March 2011. I've got the page site on that one, too. And about a week later, or a big week earlier, more or less contemporaneous, they told us that water's now available because a new line, the HCUA line, has been placed in service.
But so this was not after they found the reason why the line was messed up?
No.
Okay.
This was a whole different collection
a whole different line.
Misrepresentations. Okay. They told us we now have a new line in service, the HCUA line, so there's now sufficient water, so we're going to grant water. So they did.
Ultimately, they granted water, whether that's in time to save your client or not, they did.
Okay. Right.
So what we're dealing with is a period of a couple of years in which I'll agree your client's getting tooled around. My question is whether that tooling around is actionable under the laws that you sued under. And that's the part that I'm having trouble with. I mean, I don't, as a matter of like sort of city business, I think is a poor way to treat somebody. But that isn't the issue. So tie that into your whole allegation of FHA in 1982 and all this other stuff that makes it a federal case.
Well, we've offered evidence that the 781 group would have been a majority black development. We've offered evidence that the city...
But it's like your client driving around and saying, well, you know, this is kind of what I know about, you know, racial situations in this town. I mean, it just, even if we accept that you can have lay testimony on this, it's sort of like he's driving around and looking at people and whatever. I mean, it's not really testimony we can rest ourselves on, can we?
Well, yes.
Okay.
For all the reasons
really?
Set forth in our brief, yes.
You know, I mean, it doesn't take much then. I mean, I'm used to demographic well, studies, that kind of thing.
It would have been a lot easier to make that argument if they had ever disputed it. Their own people gave similar analyses. Their own people said, well, the people at the 781 group development are going to be just like those people in the Williamsburg project. So when their people are concurring with our people, I think the burden on us is a little less. And another thing that makes that problematic is we still back to who's the decider. We don't know who made the decision, so we don't know what they believed about the racial composition.
Why don't you give us the other four bullets, because you're starting to run out of time, and I'm just curious. You said it was five bullets. The first one was who made the decision. What are the other four? Just give them
okay.
without argument,
well,
if you don't mind, just so we have them.
Okay. We have a property right. They interfered. They shut us down for 18 months. Cost us $2 million. They claim that they did it because they had numerous studies and tests, but they made the decision first. The studies and tests came after. With regard to comparables, the city allowed 17 residential subdivisions to go forward during this same time frame. 15 of the 17, they had no fire flow information on. One of the 17 had fire flow information that showed that it complied with the 2003 ICF. One of the 17, they had fire flow information that showed it was non-compliant, but they let it go forward anyway. The whole discussion of fire flow is a pretext. The only time they enforced fire flow was against us and the 781 group. Other than that, they were not interested in the fire flow issue.
Let me just stop you right there, pretext. What is the, let's assume you do have pretext. You did a prima facie case, there's pretext. Now, what's your evidence of discrimination?
Well, for property right purposes, well, Judge Haynes has already told me she doesn't like it, but I've summarized it. For property purposes, we don't have to prove discrimination. We only have to prove arbitrary and capricious distinctions. Equal protection, the same. They enforced the fire code against two developments, us and the 781 group. They didn't enforce it against the other 17 residential developments. They didn't enforce it against four commercial developments, all of which were permitted to go forward without FCA compliance. If you enforce a statute only against the unfortunate plaintiff and not against 21 other people, you have discriminated if you've enforced
it. All this is in your summary judgment record.
Oh, yes, and in our briefs. Okay. Right. The 17, the list of 17, well, I'll stop waving things around at you, but yeah, we put in the list of the 17 houses, residential projects. We put in the city's discovery response, which said they didn't have fire flow information on those developments, but they were permitted to go forward anyway. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Council.
Good afternoon, judges. My name is Bill Whitfield. I'm here on behalf of the City of Gulfport to defend the judgment that was entered by Judge Osherden relative to this case. And I just want to say at the outset, just so you all will certainly hear me categorically say it, Judge Osherden was extremely correct in terms of his adjudication in favor of the city on a relatively complicated and rather extenuating set of circumstances. Now, if the court will just permit me just a real quick second to maybe correct maybe some things that came out on the first exchange, I might be able to maybe lend a little bit more clarity to why the judge did what the judge did. First of all, this is a claim that has been pending since essentially, I think it's in August of 10 when the case was originally filed. It was preceded by a notice of claim in April of 10 as well. The purchase of this property occurred in December of 2009. The original will serve letter that was issued in this particular case, and I got to make sure that it's clearly understood, the willingness to serve letter in this particular case only was an expression on the part of the municipality that there were lines then available to connect you as a developer or whoever to water. That occurred in 06.
Now, make sure, I know you would like to get through this without interrupting, but let me make sure what you just said, the point that's being made about the flow in that line that the city later relies upon, I would like to think is looking at that all the time, sounds important. Are you saying the will serve letter does not in any way represent that there would be a sufficient flow, or for other technical reasons, there may be a decision made that there's not an appropriate line? I'm trying to understand what you're saying the will serve letter does in relationship to the contested facts in this case.
Judge, the willingness to serve letter in the contested facts in this particular case really has got very little to do with this case. This willingness to serve letter that was issued back in 06 was issued to two predecessor developers back in 06 that were attempting to develop this property with then existing requirements for fire flow and also Department of Health requirements. The Department of Health is the entity that is primarily interested in getting this particular document simply for a lot of health reasons. The fire flow issue specifically is not something that the Department of Health is going to come in and say, yes, you have adequate fire flow. That particular responsibility is left up to the developer and his engineers as a part of their responsibility to qualify this development and ultimately submit it for permitting and certification, and ultimately so they can pull permits and put houses on lots.
How can we know, as a court, what a developer would know when he got a will serve letter?
Well, I don't know that you as a court would know what an engineer is supposed
to
know.
Well, how are we supposed to, we're supposed to determine what this letter represents to somebody who got it, and that's one of the things we're reviewing. So how can we figure out what someone in the position of the predecessor company developer would have thought, reasonably have relied on when he got this letter?
I got it. I understand. I'm not real sure, though, that what a developer, what an engineer, what I or even you would know about that or think about that letter has any real relevance as it relates to a Section 1983 civil rights claim. Because the bottom line in this particular case is that the developer is suggesting that they had a property interest based upon that will serve letter, which simply does not exist. Now, already has been cited to your honors today is the fact that before the city council, the will serve or the willingness to serve letter was somehow attached, and it was made a part of the city council record, and therefore it constitutes some type of written or implied contract. Judge, I think Judge Garza made some comment about the actual specifics, or it might have been Your Honor that made some comment about the specifics of the resolution. Absolutely nowhere in the resolution does it mention, doesn't even mention supplying water. It talks about actually hooking up to an interceptor and hooking up for the purpose of sewer. The resolution, if the courts read the resolution, it's a three-page document, very clearly talks about sewage. It does not talk about water service anywhere at all in that particular document. I don't know why the will serve letter is attached to the minutes. I don't know why. All I can suggest to the court is this, is that the resolution is very, very clear, and it's very limited in terms of its application, and it simply does not create any kind of implied or even an express commitment on the part of the city to the then developer back in 06.
What does the minutes? What do the minutes say about the attachment? Does it say the City Council this day approved, and then there's the attachment, or what's the lead-in?
Judge, the only thing that the minutes make reference to is a copy of the wastewater services agreement, a copy annexed hereto as Exhibit A. That's it.
I mean, was there a resolution, and a resolution was approved for some action or some approval by the board, by the City Council?
Judge, this particular resolution authorized the approval of the wastewater service agreement for connecting to an interceptor that was available through the Harrison County Wastewater Utility Authority. Attached as an exhibit is a copy of the form agreement.
Okay.
And then even attached even to that is a copy of the signed agreement, which authorized the then developer to hook up sewage to the Harrison County Utility Authority. Now, one real quick thing that I want to make sure that it's understood. The IFC requirement of 500 to 1,000 gallon per minute came into effect in November of 2006. November of 2006. Why does that make a
You're
difference?
You're talking about the increase where 1,000 was the minimum.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I thought you're not talking about a range. You're talking about it used to be 500, it went to 1,000
yes,
on that date.
Okay. Prior to November, I want to say it was the 6th of 2006, the GPM requirement for purposes of fighting a fire in the city of Gulfport was 500 gallons per minute. Now, on this particular line, this is an extension line from an existing water source. On this particular line, prior to November the 6th of 2006, there was compliant and certainly sufficient fire flow on this particular line. This predates the development of this particular subdivision, Roundhill. Now, what happened was is that you move on into, when you start doing different things relative to the development, you move into March of 07. In March of 07, this particular development was essentially sold, and it was, I wouldn't say that it was immediately abandoned, but it was close to immediately being abandoned in terms of its development. Now, it sat essentially idle in terms of its development and in terms of its infrastructure improvement until Mr. Matranga, through LNF, bought it in December of 09. Now, here's what you've got since the time that the development was originally conceived up until the time that Mr. Matranga, through LNF, bought the development. You've got a change in fire flow. Clearly, you've got a change in fire flow, which makes all the difference in the world, and you do not have any written commitment. You don't have any written anything in writing that anybody can find or that anybody can decipher that is justifiable reliance on a contract that can be cited by the plaintiffs in this case as a property interest. It doesn't exist. 1983, certainly I would agree with the court's implicit observations that a property interest has to be in existence or at least has to mature. In this particular case, we're not even to that point yet. So I think that on its very face, Section 1983 is simply not available in the context of this case. And Judge Haynes, you mentioned a minute ago about the city perhaps maybe being a little less than an accommodating overseer relative to how this development was developed. I got to say this. Certainly the responsibility of the city, they have responsibility when it comes to the management and to the maintenance of certain facilities. But at least in Mississippi, and certainly in the city of Gulfport, the primary responsibility of making sure that all the boxes are checked and all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, that is the responsibility of the developer. Now, when this development first was conceived in 06 as kind of a consequence and kind of a response to Hurricane Katrina, the developer had a responsibility to do X, Y, Z, A, B, and C.
Hurricane Katrina hadn't happened in 06.
Yes, it had. 05.
Oh, 05.
Okay. August 29th of 05. And then you kind of fast forward, then you get into 06. And then 06 is when the development itself started to be kind of becoming conceived. Okay? Now, the developer at that point was a totally different developer than we've got here, if any. But you've got development process that simply has to be done, and it's the responsibility of the engineers, it's the responsibility of the people that are part of that process to make sure that you've got all your ducks in order. Now, when that doesn't happen...
Okay, but I mean, it seems to me, and maybe I'm just making this too simple because it's so complicated, but it seems like this whole line with this knob that was turned the wrong way or whatever... If it hadn't been, in other words, if there had been enough flow, maybe we wouldn't be here.
Well,
and whose fault is that?
Well, look,
that sounds like that rests on you all. I mean, the developer wasn't in charge of that line. You guys were even mad that somebody went out and investigated that line without your permission and so on and so forth. So it seems to me that the knob, and I realize I'm oversimplifying the engineering of it, but I'm just going to use what I can understand.
Right.
The knob was turned off when it should have been turned on, basically. That seems to fall on y'all's shoulders.
And you know what? And I got to tell you, I certainly understand that the city might have some oversight culpability on the original construction in late 1999 and 2000. I agree with you.
Okay, so then why was the city so reluctant? I mean, why were they so resistant? It is a very kind of suspicious, sort of stinky set of facts to me, and I'm not sure that means anything legally. But it's very concerning to me that y'all were being so resistant to anything that might have revealed this knob being turned off, that might have obviated all of these problems and these people being in bankruptcy and all of that, whether you were motivated by racial motivations or anything else.
I can tell the court this. At no time was there any racial motivation relative to the decisions that were being made in connection with this water supply. Didn't happen. There is, to suggest that there is, I think to adopt Judge Johnson's comments in one of the, I think it's the Kaplan decision, that's simply mouthing, and that's his words, mouthing a justification for bringing a federal cause of action. I'll say this, even though there might have been some oversight, got no problem in terms of admitting that back in 1999 and 2000 relative to the engineering and the engineering oversight that went into this project. Because there's no question about it. There was a valve that was 4 feet in the ground that the city, by the time we discovered it, had probably undertaken about 4 or 5 times to locate. Now, Judge, up until the time that became really a relevant issue, the fire flow issue in that particular neighborhood was compliant. It only became non-compliant and insufficient when the ordinance was passed increasing the gallons per minute to 1,000. Now, if you fast forward in time from and after the GPM increase requirement, you certainly don't have any basis to assume and to understand that there is a civil rights cause of action that exists.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is, it is in the modern era, it is seldom that people are going to put in the minutes of the city council, we don't want a development because there's too many members of a certain minority that might be in that development. Let's just assume that's atypical to appear in city council minutes. So you have to usually look at circumstances and circumstantial evidence and things that don't add up. And there's so many things that don't add up here, and this is one of them, this resistance to finding this line and this sort of doggedness in defeating these developers on this issue, as well this whole misterioso about who made the decision and the stonewalling and all of that. I'm wondering at what point does all of this morph into at least something that gets past summary judgment?
Well, first of all, Judge, there's plenty of cases that come out of this court that suggest that a city doesn't have to be right in order to avoid any kind of civil rights liability, whether it be under 83, 82, the FHA, whatever. They don't have to be right. And they don't have to be ultimately right either. And in this particular case, even though the city, as it relates to the valve, this valve was not right relative to the flow. That doesn't make it a civil rights cause of action. And as far as...
And I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is we have so many... I mean, they were able to fill three 60-something page briefs with a lot of very unpleasant facts for you. And I guess I'm wondering at what point do these facts create some doubt? I agree you didn't have to be right, but create some doubt about you all's protestations of innocence. And this is a difficult area because it's a very unpleasant thing to be accused of racism, whether you're a city, a person, or anything else. And so I don't get into this discussion with you lightly, but here we are.
I understand. Judge, let me just say this. I sat over there and I heard three or four instances where factual expressions were made. And I couldn't have disagreed more with the last one that I heard relative to the installation of a meter. There has never been a meter on this property, ever. They took the deposition of Sarah Ladner, and I don't know how much of that deposition specifically is in the record, but there is no evidence, there is no testimony, there is zero, nothing in this record which gives evidence to the fact that water service as a potable and certainly a fire flow compliant existence came to this property, ever. In fact, we have asserted and stand by that assertion that water out there was hooked up to this particular city's water line illegally, and that water has been drawn from this particular line for years and years and years without authority and not the payment of one single bill, even though Mr. Matranga owned it since December of 2009.
Ms. Leary spent about 10 minutes on the question of who made the decision, so I'll ask you, who made the decision?
Judge, the decision that is at play in this particular case, the will serve letter, is signed by Chris Riemann, okay? The decision that he would not be allowed water, Judge, is in the record, and it is sent to, well, actually, it's not signed, but it's sent to the company from the Department of Public Works, which would have been Chris Riemann, which the plaintiffs in this particular case deposed not once but twice.
And is Chris a man or a woman?
Excuse me?
Chris is a man or a woman?
Man.
Okay. Did he say that he made the decision not to provide water, you know, to ultimately sort of deny the water service, the event that triggered all of this?
Judge, if I were to tell the court that I remember him specifically being asked that and responding to that question, I can't tell you that
I
remember it.
I'm guessing he was asked it since it seems like such a hot issue. What did he say?
I cannot tell you that I can remember. I can tell you this, that there's probably about 300 total pages of testimony from him.
Okay.
He was deposed, Judge, based upon a 30B6 deposition notice. Now, you might remember that there was a lot of exchanges between the parties relative to the scope of his deposition. We went by the rules in connection with how he was deposed and to what degree he was going to be deposed in, and followed the court's instructions to a T. The court's instructions to a T. Now, Judge,
just very quickly, because she's made some allegations that you haven't yet responded to, probably because I haven't given you a chance to, and we haven't collectively. She said that there were these 17 total projects, of which 15, you don't even know whether they had the right flow, and one of them didn't, and one of them did. And that these are the comparators, so that y'all are pretty much selectively enforcing this fire flow requirement against them.
She did say that.
Okay, what's your response?
And I disagree with that very strenuously. Let me say this. That probably is more applicable to an equal protection pretext argument than it is anything else that's involved in this particular case. Now, we complied with the court's order in terms of turning over data to the plaintiffs in this particular case as it relates to comparative subdivisions. The only one at the end of the day, Judge, that became relevant was a particular development in the city limits itself, for which Chris Riemann gave an affidavit suggesting that before this developer was allowed to pull the first permit, the very first permit, which allows him to sell a home, the city made him loop the line and increase the water. That's how you do it. You loop the line and you increase the water pressure to make it compliant. The city made him do that before he pulled the first permit. The other areas that are of interest to the plaintiff are commercial establishments and restaurants and other places that are down the line that have got They've got zero to do with a county-based water service that the city has the right to service. So from an equal protection standpoint, not only do the plaintiffs not, they're not able to meet either disparate treatment or disparate impact. They simply can't do it. And Judge, I see that I've got a couple of seconds. I want to say this about the whole equal protection issue. What the plaintiffs are trying to do is they're trying to juxtapose themselves against a development, 781 project, which was down the street, that never, ever got off the ground, ever. To this day, the record will reflect and suggest that if 781 wanted to come in and develop out the property down the street from where Roundhill was, they couldn't do it today. They have never, ever, ever had an appropriate permit to build on their site, ever. Because the Harrison County would be the entity that would approve that particular development. The Harrison County Board of Supervisors and that particular entity has never approved that development. They simply cannot bootstrap and make an equal protection argument out of 781.
Thank you. I bet you have a lot more you could say,
but
your time is up.
Thank you, Judge.
It applies to both sides, no doubt. Mr. Healy.
Good afternoon. I very much enjoyed this environment. The last time I had the pleasure of speaking to the court, I was before the University of Houston Law School, and we had 4,000 or 5,000 students standing behind us.
Well, we have quality behind you, but not that number.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, in this case, and one of the judges pointed out very clearly, in this case, the great weight of evidence goes to show that there was never a real, legitimate fire flow problem. Fire flow problem in the ordinance 2501 is what Gulfport rests its case on. That's where they hang their hat. They claim 2501 prohibited the going forward of the Roundhill development. It's not true, Your Honor. The great weight of evidence shows that's simply not true. In fact, Your Honor, there are a couple of real simple documents that are in the record. As you know, you have enough in this record that we could wallpaper this whole courtroom. It's a very large record. I think we have 750 docket entries. There's a couple of telling documents in the record, Your Honor. They're claiming we now have the enactment of this ordinance which requires 1,000 gallon per minute fire flow. Consequently, we have a duty, a rational basis by which to shut down this project. That is simply not true. And this is in their discovery responses. The Landon Road water line runs down Landon Road, then goes south down JFM Parkway. The 781 project is directly across the street from Roundhill. Now, the city knew in 2005 that the line servicing 781 did not have 1,000 gallon a minute.
But it needed 1,000 then,
didn't
or only needed 500 that year, correct?
That's correct. You're right. They didn't need it. But in 2008, they issued.
Now, Mr. Healy, several times you were getting away from the microphone. There are two microphones there. I don't know what the other one does. Stay behind the central.
That's a bad habit of mine. I'm a mover and a shaker.
Understood.
I'm not good at standing still.
But we want to keep this for posterity. It is being recorded.
I will stay right here. Your Honor, the Department of Public Works, the same group that sent Mr. Matringa and L&F a letter and sent the predecessor owners of Roundhill a letter in 2006, sent a letter to the 780 Run Group in 2008 claiming water is available, you can move forward with your 98-unit multifamily townhouse development. Now, this is right down the street from where the test was performed in 2005, showing what the fire flow was. This letter in 2008 is after the enactment of 2501, which incidentally doesn't even speak to the county. It speaks to buildings inside the city of Gulfport. This is outside. Make no mistake about that. They didn't care about fire flow. The city had no interest in fire flow. They were happy with this project as originally brought forth. The original project was for a townhouse and 13-lot single-family residential developments. Everybody was happy with it. Later, they came back and said, we're going to put Katrina cottages here. Katrina cottages were associated with crime, filth, low-income folks, folks like that trailer park, folks like that other park that we talked about. And we quoted in our brief, and we cited references to the hearings that were held when the citizens spoke about the undesirable people that were there.
What does that do to your case? You have some citizens saying that. Does that in some way create a presumption that the city itself acted on that basis? How do you connect what citizens say to the decision-making?
That's part of the overall picture, Your Honor. If we've pointed out, there was no problem with fire flow. Everybody was happy with it. That just goes to show, once again, it wasn't until that point in time that the city said, we're not going to accept this project. And since we were right across the street, we were collateral damage. Had we been given water flow, had they approved us saying fire flow is adequate, they would have had to have given it to the 781
board. Mr. Healy, but you're reciting, in essence, your speculation. There's nothing tying, there's two speculations in this, or two linkages. Number one, you tying into the 761, that's the reason they did it. There's no evidence of that. And I'm not even sure there's sufficient circumstantial evidence, in the most favorable light to your client. And then the other aspect is, you're correct, there wasn't a fire flow problem. They made a mistake. That's it. There's no evidence to distinguish between them making a mistake and them making a decision, an intentional decision, based on some type of discrimination or being arbitrary and capricious. You haven't taken the next step. I just want you to comment on those two points.
I respectfully disagree, with all respect. I believe the two documents I just showed you are dispositive of the issue. Why did they give a will serve letter then in 08, after the enactment? Why did they do that? Why did they send Mr.
Why do you ask questions when I'm not sure a question elicits is evidence of confirmation of discrimination or being arbitrary and capricious? This might have been a great jury question, but at this point we've got summary judgment. If there's any evidence tying this discrimination or tying the consciousness of the city to arbitrary and capricious, other than what you've just finished. I mean, we know the circumstantial evidence. Is there anything else?
Well, yes. Wayne Miller showing up in 2010 saying, this is it. Finish this punch list, and you're good to go. Then later they stopped him. And the three cases that are, we believe, very similar to ours, Semi Investment, City of Galveston, Mikeska. Thank you for your time, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank both sides for bringing this case to us. We'll take it under consideration. We will be in recess for 10 minutes.